We are being taught in the schools of this land that we are nothing more or other than descendants from the ape family over millions of years ago. There are no ifs or buts. These are the facts. There is no alternative possibility given to us, like creation by God. It doesn't enter the picture at all. In any case, not in the books that I viewed, which were all in the social studies handbooks. I didn't see one reference to God or the possibility that God could have been the cause of how we got here. Now, I was rather taken aback when this happened, because I heard a talk given by Dr. Pandor at a genome conference at Stellenbosch, at Spiever, the hotel outside Stellenbosch, some years ago. What year was it? I've forgotten now. And 2002. And there she expressed her misgivings about many things that are being said under the umbrella of evolutionism. And I ask in this book, Dr. Pandor, what happened to you? She said that there were things that were damaging to the students. And what was that? It was the racist connotations which she knew about in Darwinism, and that is what her misgivings were about. But subsequently, she's forgotten about that, and now she underwrites this whole curriculum that we are looking at in our schools. And I point out in this book that Darwin was, in fact, extremely racist. The original title of the book said it, that it was really to prove the superiority of the Caucasian race above all the others, and that the others actually deserved to be wiped out. At the same conference, Dr. Bernard Leitchon of Stellenbosch, who used to be a theologian, whom I've known for many years, he pleaded for inclusivity, so that apart from creation, the evolution doctrine would also be taught. But we did not get inclusivity, we got exclusivity. But my point in this book is that creation is not merely a religious preference, but that it is a more truthful reflection of existing scientific data. Not just what you find in the Bible, scientific data. And if you look at that objectively, you will find that it is not differing from what the scriptures say. Why they disregard this government, why they disregard the belief system of 70% plus of the population of this country, I cannot understand, but at the same time I can. Because it doesn't matter to this government what you believe, they will force upon you what they believe. So in spite of the majority by a long way believing in the Bible and in the Christian doctrines, in spite of that, they've introduced evolution as though it's the only and only truth that there is. So, I try to bring out in this book, where does this doctrine take you? Francis Schaeffer taught me that, and I had the privilege of meeting Francis Schaeffer in Switzerland years ago. So it was one of the highlights of my visit to Europe that year. I think it was 1976. And he always says, look out for where whatever it is that you are believing takes you. Where does it end? And I implore all of you to do that when looking at any new bit of knowledge. Where does it lead? What is its ultimate conclusion? What we are being told is that in South Africa, an attempt is being made to accommodate all of the various religions, all of the various mindsets that people have, so that we cannot possibly accept the Christian religion as the basis of our society or a basis of government or anything else. We've got to be as inclusive as possible. Now, so they are trying to tell us that what we have now, which is an atheist position, they are trying to tell us that the atheist position is the most inclusive of all positions. But the reverse is true. I will come to something more about that in a minute. I ask in chapter 2, speak about evolution as a statement of faith. And this is one of the major things I need to express tonight. That evolutionism and all that, is not something that you can open a textbook and say 1 plus 1 is 2. There is the answer. You can't, like mathematics, you can't deny it. It's there and it's true. It is scientifically proven. There is nothing in evolutionism and evolution that can be proved scientifically. It is all wishful thinking. It is presuppositions. It is a spectacle through which you look at everything. And that is the answer you get because you are looking through those particular spectacles. And you won't find another answer because you haven't put the right spectacles on to find the other answer. The one you've put on is to find only the answers that we come from the apes and that everything happened by chance. But this is not the way I believe you and I see it. And then I feel I need to lay a bit of emphasis on the following. What is evolution, actually? Because what you read in this magazine, what you read in that article, and in every newspaper article that you find, or wherever, today, they will be proposing and holding forth what one would call microevolution as real evolution. Now, I don't even like to use the word microevolution, because microevolution is the variations which you get within a species. You get up to 250 kinds of dogs. It's quite a lot, huh? Microevolution. It's actually not evolution at all. But they like you and I to use the word evolution, because then they've caught you. Don't use the word evolution for that. It's variations within a species. You can have probably another 100 kinds of dogs before the Lord returns. You can have many strains of cattle, of peaches, of anything, wheat, anything you like. But the wheat doesn't become, strawberries. The ox never becomes a giraffe. The elephant never becomes a dinosaur. He always remains an elephant. The horse remains a horse. And the pictures you see in textbooks up to this day, in fact, is it in this one? That National Geographic there? The progression from the small horse, big as a sheep, they know for years it's alive. You can read in evolutionist textbooks, or books, not textbooks, because they still propagate the lie in the textbooks. They know it's a lie, but they still propagate it because it supports the case. And as long as somebody doesn't object, they will keep doing that. That other illustration of Haeckel, which I've also got in my book here, I will find it and show it to you. or will I find it? It's of the early beginnings of life. The life forms, and how that all of them look the same in its very early stages. There the illustrations are. Now, those illustrations of the amoeba of various things, and that is from a salamander, from a human being, and from a tortoise and something else, and the chicken, and the goats and the frog. They say, he says, that they all look exactly the same. So they've all got the same origin. All come from the same place. But the real situation, because all of that is a lie, that's misrepresentation. And he was brought before a court of law in Germany, and he was found guilty of fraud and deception. There is what they really look like in that line, and that's the end product for them all. So this fraud is still being propagated at Stellenbosch University to this very day, and probably most universities around the world. Variations within species, to come back to that, is not evolution. And never budge away from that position. Do not give in to admit that it's microevolution, because evolution doesn't exist. And when you say that, then they say, I thought you said you weren't an evolutionist. Of course you believe in evolution. No, you don't believe in evolution. Because evolution is a dog becoming a horse. There is no case that has ever been found. R.C. Sproul, the noted theologian, said, if God is, chance is not. If God created everything, chance, happenings, and evolution is not. But alternatively, if chance is, God is not. If it can be proved that everything happened by accident, chance, accident. In fact, all of it's supposed to be accidents. They are off the normal run of development or of progress or of growth in the cell, in its multiplications, mode of multiplication. It's the mistakes that create what they call evolution. Because else you would, if it started off as a horse, it would always be a horse, 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 with no mistakes. But they say, oh no, there was a mistake, and the genetic makeup of that mistake caused it to start becoming something else. Then out of that animal, there was another mistake, and out of that there's another slight variation until it one day becomes an elephant. All of these mistakes are the word, very big word, deleterious. There is not one of these mistakes, genetic mistakes, which are beneficial. And 99% of them are lethal. In other words, it leads to death. The thing dies. So the mistake gets you nowhere. The mistake remains a mistake. And it doesn't lead to anything positive. So they are saying, the evolutionists, that to get evolution, you are increasing the information in the type or in the animal or whatever it might be, or the plant. You are increasing information, but yet that is the very point that has never and can never be proven. So they say there are millions of examples of evolution all around the world. And all of these articles, as I've said, and all the talks on the radio will be saying that, oh man, I mean, how can you be so stupid? Look at the fossil record, and you will see that there are enormous amount of variations from then to now. I will probably come, if I remember, back to that kind of subject a bit later on. Now, what were the fruits of this doctrine? Because, as this states, this is not science. Can we all see that? Praise Darwin, that's not science. Evolve beyond belief, well, if you can't believe it, then it's not science either. Freedom from religion foundation. So this is not propagating science. It's propagating a worldview. It's propagating atheism. It is propagating that we should get rid of God. That is what evolution is all about. We must get rid of God. And the way this has escalated in the last 6 months is beyond description. I've been astonished and dismayed at what is being said and written and projected on screens around the world. It's to destroy any knowledge of God as quickly as possible. If we can do it all today, we won't wait until tomorrow. Back then, in Darwin's time, what was it that gripped the attention of people that believed in what he was saying? Of natural selection. These things happen naturally on their own without any intervention of humans. What was it in his dogma that attracted the attention of people? The scientists, by the way, for one or two generations did not accept Darwinism. They discarded it outright. They said, this is not science. This is philosophy. This is a worldview. This is a method to get rid of God out of the minds and hearts of people. You are destroying people's faith. Marx wrote to Engels, Darwin's book, referring to Darwin's book, this is the book which contains the basis in natural history for our view. Now, Marx and Engels both agreed that communism was based squarely on a materialistic, evolutionistic view of life. And Darwin provided that naturalistic basis for them, their philosophical starting point. A year later, Marx was writing again to Engels, and he said, socialism and Darwinism are only artificially and on the surface separable. Socialism and Darwinism are one. And there was another quote I wanted to read, but I suppose it's a bit later on in the book, of the astonishing things that they, in Marxist Russia, they allowed themselves to do in the name of a scientific approach to government. Because Darwin lent them the stemple, what's a stemple in English? I can't think of the word. The chup, you know, you get the chup at the post office.
The stamp,
okay. The stamp of approval that it is science. They were busy with science, you see, the Marxists. And that made it acceptable because Darwinism was not being accepted by the scientists, but the people at large. In big business, Darwinism was accepted, the survival of the fittest. Rockefeller made sure that he was the fittest to survive. And his practices in economics and in business were despicable. But he based it on Darwin, you see. And he based it on, and that is scientific, you see. And that is natural, you see. That's the way it should be. The fittest shall survive. And all of these people, and those that followed them, employed this in their thinking. Freud is a good example of this. There's a couple, Drs. M. and S. Hall, who used to be Marxists and evolutionists, in their book, The Truth, God, or Evolution, they were converted, said, Freud's effect on modern beliefs about sexual matters has been the primary force in the sexual revolution. There are direct connections from Freudianism to increased pornography, to attacks on the family unit, to soaring divorce rates, to gay lib, to almost casual abortions, and to other exhortations to make sexuality the be-all and end-all of life. All of Freudianism is based on Darwinism. Education in America, as adopted and introduced by Dewey, John Dewey, Professor John Dewey, went the same way. He was determined to change the entire basis of American schools to the philosophy of Darwin. He said, the origin of species introduced a mode of thinking that in the end was bound to transform what? Science? To transform the logic of knowledge and hence the treatment of morals, politics, and religion. If that's not all-encompassing, I don't know what is. The logic, transform the logic of knowledge. We see that outside today. Everything has been changed in terms of Darwinism. And the treatment of morals, what morals? What have we got left? Treatment of politics, I mean, the fittest shall survive, and we will impose our will on the people. I mean, how's Mugabe doing in that respect? And religion. I mean, Darwinism has swallowed up the Christian church to a very large degree. Because the theologians are believing that evolution is true. And because that is true, the Bible is not true. And Genesis 1 to 11 is not true history. It is, they are myths to convince us to believe in something which is not scientifically verifiable or scientifically true. So we are left with a society which is bereft of its foundation, which always has been the Word of God. And so I challenge this minister we have to do with here. How could you allow this to happen? I want to go back to that thing of what changed in the world outside. A mode of thinking transforms the logic of knowledge, the treatment of morals, politics, and religion. So all of the basic building blocks of society has changed dramatically through this Darwinism. Now, I have another chapter thereafter on what I call baloney detection. And you need to know these things and to enable you to identify when they are talking utter rubbish and how to catch them out. I won't go into that now. It's there as a chapter. And then the next chapter deals with what are the issues at stake. How is it that this in particular in South Africa has been accepted so easily as, you know, without a ripple on the surface? You see how you do it. You say, well, South Africa is probably the most diverse country in the world. Do you agree with that in broad terms?
Yes.
There's no other place like this. So what do you do to accommodate this whole spectrum of beliefs and of cultures and of everything else? How do you accommodate this? So which approach to all of these matters that we are dealing with every day out there, which approach would seem to be more all-embracing or, conversely, more value-free, that you are not saying, this is the right answer. Oh, well, that is the right answer. None of that. We want a value-free answer. The answer of the department is the scientific one. Science is supposed to be neutral, you see. Isn't that clever? Science is neutral. I mean, you're putting something in a test tube, and what comes out, I mean, it's what you put in, and if you put heat under it, it may explode in your face, but you are getting what you put, all the components that you put in, you're getting out. So you can say 1 + 1 = 2. Answer. Science is neutral. And this is the catch. Science has enabled us to rise above the idea of a God who is not the same for everybody, and who therefore cannot unite diverse peoples. See how clever it is. Unity must be achieved through a common way of thinking based on scientific reasoning, which is the same for everyone. After all, religious beliefs are about feelings, divergence from reality. Religious beliefs are about feelings, not about verifiable facts. And this, I must just say in brackets here, and this is why we are sitting here tonight, because we believe that the Bible from page one consists of verifiable facts, history. That is why it's so important not to give an inch away of what stands in the Bible as history. It's not feelings. What evidence could there be against scientific facts? Only science deals in facts, so they say. All of the other is beliefs, feelings, religious superstitions, all sorts of other things. Only science deals in facts. So that is the big lie. So that's where Darwin steps in, and Darwin gives us the whole rundown of how his doctrine really has taken control of the entire world out there. But Isaiah 42 verse 8 tells us something completely different, that God will not allow the honor which is due to him as a creator to be given to anyone else. Isaiah 42 verse 8, remember that verse. The consequence of this Darwinism is a disastrous belief that science can control moral affairs and deal with them in a purely scientific way, leaving religion and faith in God out of the equation. Now, the question may be asked, now, how is it that science got into this position? Ask yourself as you sit here, and I'll hesitate for a second or two more. How did science get into this position of authority? I believe through the successes of science. The fact that men have walked on the moon. What enormous technological expertise was not required to get that, apart from the money? And the absolute precision to get there and not falling off the edge. I mean, no, not that, but in missing it altogether, just going on to space, into space, forever and ever, goodbye, astronauts. It's through the great achievements of science, which in the last 50 years have dramatically risen like that. And we can't deny it. Science has made tremendous strides. I mean, unbelievable things can be done. I mean, a man can sit in Cape Town here at his computer, and he can do an operation in Sweden over at the computer. Don't ask me how it happens, but it can be done. He can perform an operation in Sweden, which they can't do there. Science is mind-boggling. So the exact, and those are what we call the exact sciences. Biology, and where we all came from, that's not an exact science. Paleontology, of looking at bones, that's not an exact science. It's guesswork. And so many other things. Astronomy, a lot of it is guesswork. One astronomer said, if you ask me, this is now the head of the Jodrell Bank Astronomy Center, whatever they call it in English, in outside London. If you were to ask me how far that star is, he says, I could not tell you. He said, what? Can't you tell me how far that star is? The answer is no. What? Why no? Because the answer I give you would be an answer based on my presuppositions. You have a certain framework, a certain spectacle. through which you look at the stars. And therefore, if you want to know how far that star is, you must ask, well, through what spectacle did you look at that star? What are your presuppositions? What did you accept as being the truth? And then I might be able to tell you, but generally speaking, he can't tell you. Just by looking at the star, he can't tell you how far the star is. Because they are all presuppositions. And probably 90% of astrophysics is presuppositions, or the answers of presuppositions that they have to produce the Big Bang, which, by the way, there are 91 things that need to have happened in the Big Bang, scientifically, for it to actually have worked. And only one of them actually did happen. So the other 90 have all been guessed and hoped that it did happen. I say, concerning all of this stuff about evolution and the lack of testability, that the blindness of our present government is only exceeded by its unsurpassed arrogance by removing God from the equation of our existence on this earth. Then I'm going to talk about the aims of evolutionary teaching, and I actually mentioned it at the start. It's to get rid of God. Now listen to what Professor George Volt from Harvard University, the university. One has only to scientist, a Nobel Prize winner, one has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet, here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. Time is in fact the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal is in the order of 2 billion years. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. How's that for logical reasoning? One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracle. Now, you will agree that he is aware of the facts, that he's not talking about science here. It's a belief. Right? Then there's another chap, also a Harvard, Professor Richard Lewontin. He said in the New York Review of January 1996, it's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material evolutionistic explanation of the world out there, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. This arch-evolutionist prepared to admit it's not that science is telling us that this is the way to go, and this is what happened. It's our a priori, our beliefs up front, that has caused, because we dare not give God a chance to put his foot in the door. Professor Philip Johnson of University of California, about both of these sayings, he said, thus, to a materialist, it is better to put up with a lot of bad science than allow a divine foot in the door. You put up with all this rubbish because you know the alternative is to acknowledge that there is a God out there. To sum up, the aim of evolutionary teaching is pure materialism. It is to banish God from the minds of our children as they face their future. Are we, as citizens, I ask in the book, going to stand by and watch how future generations are brainwashed in this way? Now then I go on to speak about the presuppositions, and I won't go into that. The fruits of the evolutionary presupposition, I won't go into that, because you could possibly even buy the book and read it for yourself. But I just want to stop a minute at a branch of science called cryptozoology. Now, cryptozoology is crypto because it's you can't see it. It's sort of an invisible or an unknown quantity in zoology. Now, Professor De Bias of Wits University, he is on the board of cryptozoology. Cryptozoology is when you find a new species somewhere, or way out in the bush, you find a little animal, an insect, or what? An animal of sorts. And nobody's seen it before, nobody has recorded it, so they bring it to the board of cryptozoology, and they look at it, and they say, help, we haven't seen this before, they give it a name. And he admitted, Tobias, that his colleagues were hunting Astrolepithecus in Central Africa at the time of that meeting. I've forgotten what the year it was, but that is recorded in a thick book I have like that, Forbidden Archaeology, written not by Christians, but to Hindu believers, scientists. They are scientists. But in a book that thick, Forbidden Archaeology, they tell about this event of Tobias saying that his colleagues are hunting these ape men, in other words. That guy. They were hunting them. Now, I ask in this book, if they were hunting them, why does the same professor say that those half people, half animals existed 500,000 years ago? And his colleagues are now hunting them in Central Africa.
And why are they hunting them if they are human beings or part human beings?
Well, you know, they just believe they're not yet human beings, but why are they still there? They should have evolved long ago. And, I mean, these ape men, you find them all over the world, but you never hear about it. In my first book, I had a whole chapter on it, of these ape men in America, in North America, in South America, in the Himalayas, where you know about the abominable snowmen, and in China, you know it. People, these predecessors of humans, are up to 3 meters tall. Actually found in our day, but you'll never hear about them in the press. Anyhow, here he is admitting that these animals, beings, that should have been there 500,000 years ago are still living today. So it knocks the whole of the scientific theory into a cocked hat.
Did they not mean that because of the missing link? Because they haven't found a missing link.
No, I mean, they're trying desperately, and so they are, and they're trying to chop them out of the caves at Sterkfontein too, to find that one link which is going to prove the whole thing true. A thoughtful evolutionist, Jean-Louis Aswaga, admitted, we are human beings, in spite of what I've just said, and an evolutionist says this, we are unique and alone in the world. There is no other animal species that truly represents our own. A physical and mental chasm separates us from all other living creatures. There is no other bipedal, two-footed mammal. No other mammal controls or uses fire, writes books, travels in space, paints portraits, or prays. This is not a question of degree. It is all or nothing. There is no semi-bipedal animal. None that back only small fires, writes only short sentences, builds only rudimentary spaceships, draws just a little bit, or prays just occasionally. It's all or nothing. You've either got a human being or you haven't. Then I come to a question that really tickles me, the geological column and dating methods. Now, you must have seen it in museums. You'll find the illustration of all the layers, the sedimentary layers. And, of course, 4,600 million years, when you add all the layers together, one is 190 million years that took to be laid down. The next one is 540 million years. How they know? I don't know.
541.
Sometimes. It's even the one, yeah. But the interesting thing is, apart from the time that they took to be laid down, they also give you the depth in kilometers. And when you add all of that together, you come up to, I've done this, and I've not come across anybody else that's done this. But I did it, being as stupid as I am. And I found it comes to 135.8 kilometers in depth. Now, the deepest total sedimentary layer, the deepest one in the world, is 25 kilometers. So we are being lied to the tune of 110.8 kilometers. But that's the most, the 25 kilometers. The average is 16. And it could become as little as 8 in some parts of the world. So not only are the depths that we are told are there a lie, the time must therefore also be a lie. So the greatest amount of time that can be generated, according to their own figures, if 4,600,000 years gave us 135 kilometers depth, then the new reduced level of 25 kilometers gives you less than 600,000 years, which is 4,000 million years less. Now that must make quite a difference to your calculations, or maybe to your belief system. You may think, wait a minute, something's radically wrong here. But when you take this matter further, when you divide up the actual depth with the time, then you come to a rate of deposition, in other words, the deposits of sedimentary matter or sand or whatever it is, in these layers, it comes to an annual deposit of 0.03 of a millimeter thick. Now, how thick is that? It's of the thinnest hairs on my head, and I haven't got too many left. Of the thinnest hairs, that is about 0.03 of a millimeter thick. Now, if you got deposits, and this is what evolution says, it's not me, evolution says that we have had a uniformitarian past. Everything happened year after year after year after year, the same speed, that erosion has taken place from the mountains, and it's all landed up nicely, neatly in layers like this, and in them we find the fossils. Now this, you must realize how clever this is. The fossils you will have seen in the same museum at the bottom, all these tiny insects, animal trilobites, and all of those things that are very, very small. And as you go up the geological column, so the animals get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger till you get the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And so it goes on. What is that true to start with? Answer is no. Because there are many places in the world, there go my papers, there are many places in the world where the very same things are in reverse. Where you get the big animals at the bottom and the smaller ones on the top. Or jumbled up. Because all of these layers are not laid down over billions of years. Now this is where biblical history comes in. This is where the flood of Noah comes in. And this is where you and I believe that the biblical flood was the cause of all these layers that were deposited all in 1 year. 40 days and 40 days and nights of rain and opening up the waters of the deep. So there's plenty and plenty and plenty of water and plenty of mud and plenty of catastrophes all over the globe of swirling waters. I mean, the floods that we've had and seen on television lately, your mind boggles and thinks, oh, goodness. But think of a worldwide flood. So that all of the animals, apart from those in the ark, would have been caught up in this flood and would have been fossilized, because they had nowhere else to go. So they were caught up in this muddy water, and as it settled and settled and settled, they fossilized. And you need five things to get a fossil. You can't get a fossil in 0.03 millimeters per annum. Now, there's a tadpole would take over 200 years to to fossilize. I mean, a tadpole, can you believe it? A dinosaur on its side was a good few hundred million years for a dinosaur to fossilize. Now, we must all know that's totally impossible, because unless the animal was overtaken there and then by this mud and he died, and he remained in this mud until all of that mud's hardened into rock, and that his bones were infiltrated with the salts and so on in the mud, and that it fossilized and became almost stone. That could never have happened over millions and millions of years. It must have been instantaneous. That is why we have fossils today, because it all overtook them. And why, generally speaking, are all the small animals at the bottom, and the further up you go, the bigger the animals? Because the ones at the bottom couldn't run fast enough when the water was rising. And as the waters rose, those that were bigger and could run further and could see further ran further and higher until they were caught in a crevice in the mountains that they couldn't get up. There are fossil graveyards in kloofs in mountains around the world, where all the different kinds of animals are together in that kloof. The lions with the deer and with the elephants and with the giraffe, they're all together. The bones are mixed up in these fossil graveyards. How would they have got there? Because they were fleeing from the flood. How would you see in Mount Rose in Texas, in the United States, dinosaur footprints with human footprints over there and in them, and them all running in the same direction, if it was not upcoming waters of a flood, which threw another layer of mud over the previous layer, and so the prints even were fossilized. Only a universal flood. Why do you find so few human remains in fossilized? Because the humans had the biggest brains, and so if I go up that mountain, I'm going to get caught in that kranz, which the animal, the giraffe and the ostrich and all that would never see, and he would say, oh, no, I've got to go around this way, and where he got to the top anyway, the waters overtook him, and he was either eaten by the sharks, or he rotted away, or the millions of people in the world rotted away. That is this wonderful thing we read about the geological column, and that Darwin and company drew up when 80% of the Earth's crust had not yet been scientifically established. They drew it up, so it's a story in the first place, and in the last place as well. And we are asked to believe that because it is displayed in every museum around the world, except the one Christian museum in the United States. Now, why is it that scientists have not discovered all this rubbish being taught about evolution? Because, to a very large degree, a scientist is a one-track-minded guy. If he is a paleontologist, that's all that he knows. He knows nothing about genetics, he knows nothing about morphology, and he knows nothing about 101 other things. He relies on those other scientists in those disciplines to tell him what's going on. So at this conference I told you about, Tobias was the chairman, and the speaker was from the British Museum, and he said at this conference that we have found a skull. Now, he was speaking to geneticists from all over the world. There were 6 Nobel Prize winners in the audience, and me. Now, this guy from British Museum said, this skull we have discovered is 30,000 years old. We discovered it now recently in Tanzania. These people, all geneticists sitting there except me. Wow, this is fantastic. So at the end, question time, I was the first to have my hand up, and Tobias, not knowing me, he does now, said, now, you at the back there, so what's your question? I said, well, the speaker, Dr. Stringer, said that this skull is 30,000 years old, measured by the carbon-14 dating method. You've all heard about it. I won't go into the detail. And I said, but it is well known that you cannot measure the age of anything over the 5,000 years old, but generally between 3 and 5,000 years accurately. So what does the speaker say? He says, yes, sir, you are quite right. Isn't that astonishing? Because 10 minutes prior to that, he said, that's how we measured the age of the skull. So then he had to backtrack and say, we measured the age of the skull by the rock layer it was found in. So I put my hand up again and said to Tobias, said, sorry, you've had your question. He knew what I was going to ask, namely, how do you know how old the rock layer is? And then he would have to answer because of the kind of skull, the fossil we find in it. Then I would ask, now, how do you know how old the fossil is? Then he would have to answer because of the kind of rock we find it in. So you find the age of the one from the other. The paleontologist goes to the geologist and says, how old is that rock? And he looks at it. What fossils are in there? Yeah, find that fossil. Looks in his book. 362 million years. That's how it's done. It's circular reasoning. The one convinces the other, and they pat each other on the back, and they go home and have a good, solid whiskey. And everything in the garden is lovely. That is what science is these days, or evolutionistic science. Now, there are ways and means of measuring the age of the Earth and of the atmosphere and all sorts of things, and I'll go into that a little inside here, and I'll just mention one of them. A man that's done the study of comets, he says it's impossible that the Earth can be older than 6,000 years. After that, comets disintegrate completely. Halley's Comet is the last one, and in fact, last time he was here a few years ago, it was busy integrating as it passed the Earth. The Earth's magnetic field, has been decaying at a rate of halving every 1,400 years. So even 7,000 years ago, the magnetic strength of the magnetic field of the Earth would have been so great that no life would have been possible on Earth. So there are other means of physical ways of measuring the age of the Earth. And it all tells you, in fact, one of the measurements was such that they measured the argon, potassium argon method of the lava flow of a volcano somewhere in the Far East. And they said, according to that method, the age of the volcano flow was 3 million years. And when they looked up the history books at that place, to their dismay, they found it was only 190 years. Subtle difference between the two figures. Evolution is there to undermine the Word of God. Obstacles in biology I go into. I won't say much about that, except to say that mathematically, evolution is entirely impossible. When you look at the composition of a cell and the millions and millions of bits of information in a cell, of one cell, all of those bits of information must combine with one another in a certain way to get a certain answer, to get the cell to live on and for that cell to become a human or a horse or a donkey or whatever. Everything has got to happen in a particular order. The mathematical chance of that happening in one cell, I'm not talking about the rest, one cell, and one aspect of it called chirality. Now, don't ask me what the meaning of it is. I'm not going to tell you now. But the chance of that happening by chance is 1 in 10 to the power of 33,000. Now, that chance is so small that if you had a pinprick, something the size of a pinprick, in the whole known universe, as we know it today, or which we don't know, but we think we know it, and you multiplied the entire existence of all the universes together five times, you must be able to pick out and identify that one pinprick. That is about one chance in 10 to the power of 33,000. That is the chance that evolution could have taken place within one cell. Now, I think it must strike us all as beyond the bounds of possibility. So that I say a little bit about mathematics, and then I summarize evolutionary doctrine and say that we have nothing here to do with science. We have to do with a belief system. And why is it that only the Bible is attacked? I say here on page 86, I've never heard of an evolutionary scientist who has set out to discredit the Quran, the writings of Buddha, Hinduism, Shintoism, Confucianism, Sikhism, or any other religion, because they all know that there's only one source of ultimate truth which needs to be destroyed at all costs, the Bible as the Word of God. Then, I'm sorry, I've taken far more time. I should stop now. Then I go into the history of our origins, and that's part of the title of the book, African Eve, because Eve came out of Africa, you guys. Eve came out of South Africa, Southern Africa. The history of our origins. So they put a line through all of the Mesopotamian history and archaeology, and all of written history up to this present moment, or last year or the year before, put a line through all of that. It's all incorrect. Mankind started in Southern Africa. And this they now try to prove genetically. And this is where the joke comes in. Because I attended the meeting in Cape Town with this guy that's doing this genetic gymnastics all around the world, and he takes a sample of your spit or something, and he can tell you from what strain of DNA you come way back, and all happily lands up in Southern Africa. Eve. This is where humankind started. Amazing. And as I sat there, I thought to myself, you know, I'm too stupid to know what the real facts are, because I'm not a geneticist. But I know there is somewhere along the line a huge presupposition that leads him to that conclusion. And lo and behold, you find it in a book by Martin Lubino called Bones of Contention. And therein, he sets out this whole history, not history, but sets out how the presuppositions that they use with this computer program to prove where you came from, that there are flaws in the program. And that if you entered the material in a slightly different way, you would come up with a totally different answer. And so even one of the people, the scientists, that worked out this way of finding out through genetics where you all come from, he has retreated from his position and admitted with the writer, with the editor of Nature, that is a lot of hogwash. So that, you see, they will find a tool and will bluff 99.99% of the population. That this is science, guys. This is science. You can't argue with it. DNA science. I mean, it's a thing right up there now. But it is not true. They are bluffing their way through because their presuppositions are false. I won't go into the archaeological finds that substantiate the Bible as being true as compared with evolutionistic rubbish. In, I just want to mention two of these people, and the one is William Foxwell Albright, a brilliant archaeologist. He has five different doctorates in five disciplines. and he tells us there is no book that compares with the Bible for accuracy, for dates of anything. There's nothing to compare with the Bible. No other historical account comes near the Bible. And the more he has done research in archaeology, the more he comes to that conclusion. And the second one is Dr. David Rawl, who has written two fascinating books, which I've got on my shelf, beautiful books. And he, as a non-believer, he writes a book, A Test of Time, the Bible from myth to history. Not from history to myth. The Bible from myth to history. And he says the Bible is the most authentic historical record we have of the earth's history. And so I go on, and then I speak about the flood and early history and why the flood is actually the answer to what we see in the world out there. And then I go on to speaking about the authority of the scriptures. I also speak about paleontology, a distorted history. I've already mentioned a lot of it. And then the authority of the scriptures. How come that the scriptures have this authority? And I approach the subject as if before a court of law, so that you can say, all right, where is your evidence? Mr. Pelzer, where's your evidence? Okay, here is my evidence. This is the find, archaeologically speaking, and that proves 7777. And it coincides exactly with what the Bible says. And I could take thousands of cases like this in archaeology alone, which coincides exactly with the Bible. In fact, many things are now believed not because somebody out there said so, they find it in the Bible and then they later on discover, like the 10 kings, I think, a list of 10 kings consecutive in Kings, the book of Kings, that people thought long ago, oh, the Bible, I mean to say, these kings never even existed. And then to their dismay, they find, but they did exist. And they find tablets which prove that they existed in exactly that order. So, I mean, the Bible is actually an incredibly wonderful book. It's been preserved by God's grace through all the years. And I also spend a little bit of time on the prophecies, because that is a way of proving the truthfulness of a document. If the document says, and this you find in, is it Isaiah or Jeremiah? It says, the way to find out if it's a prophecy is true, did it happen? Quite simple. If it said in 50 years' time so-and-so is going to happen, did it happen? And if it did happen, then the prophecy is true. That's the way the Bible says. And you could then go back in history and all the prophecies of the Old Testament, of the coming of Jesus Christ to this earth. Did it happen? Yes, it did happen. And the things prophesied about what Jesus himself would do on this earth, did it happen? There were 7 prophecies on the day of the crucifixion alone, prophesied in the Old Testament, that happened all in one day. And the chance of that happening is one chance in about 200 million. So you can, in a scientific fashion, go to the Bible and test it and find that the Bible is true, because it says that's going to happen, and here it did happen in history. So you've got to stick to the historicity of the Bible as absolutely infallible, and not just maybe it's true, or parts of it's true, or it's nice if it were true, or the message in it is true, but not the facts. All of that is, you draw a line through it, because you and I believe that the Bible is historically and scientifically true. My throat is wearing out a bit. I'm using it, my voice incorrectly, because I get carried away. And then I spend a little bit of time on the Bible numerics, which I don't know if you ever read about it, you know anything about it, but it's a fascinating subject. I don't want to say that that's the be-all and end-all, but to me, it proves an enormous amount of the structure of the Bible, and that each letter in the Hebrew and Greek languages has a value. And you take the creation verse, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The whole verse is multiples of seven. If you take the vowels, take the consonants, you take I've forgotten all the words. You take each one of these things and the whole structure, it's all, everything, it's a multiple of seven. And so you can take any passage of scripture. The wonderful catching of 153 fish in the New Testament. That whole passage is multiples of 153. And that all has to do with evangelism. Now, a Russian guy who was an atheist, and he started learning Greek and Hebrew, the language, because he fled to America and he became a professor there at Harvard University. He started using that, being an atheist, and he discovered this numerical pattern throughout the whole Bible. And these incredible systems of numbers that you can find everywhere in the Bible. And if that's not scientific proof of the inspiration of the Bible, in fact, he challenged anybody to write one sentence that had the same numerical kind of structure in it. And nobody has yet succeeded yet. That is all I am going to say. Not want to say, am going to say. And I think we have the wonderful privilege of having the most incredible book, document, given by God. I mean, picture it. The Creator of heaven and earth has given us this book. And he has told us that that which is in this book is his word. And that if you come to him, you have eternal life through his Son. And that he actually gives it if you confess your sin. And all the other things that this book tells us about, of how shall we then live, the title of one of Schaeffer's books, how shall we then live? We live according to the Bible. And we disregard it at our peril. And all of us do at various times in our lives when the temptations become too large for us and we fall. But thank God that by his grace we can get up and that he forgives as he forgave David. And everywhere else in the scriptures, because there's nobody that is perfect. So we need his grace and his forgiveness that we may accept. And I'm happy to say that this Bible is an incredible book. This Bible is God's word. This Bible is the only sure thing that we've got in this world on which to base our lives here and in the life to come. Thank you. You the chairman.
But may we ask a few questions?
Questions?
Yes. Would anyone like to ask?
That's to say if I can answer.
I have to ask probably a very simple one. What is the Dutch Reformed Church's position on the accommodation of the church?
Well, it is in a quandary. If you were to take the powers that be, all the guys up in the top there in the synod and all that, I would think that 90% of them believe evolution to be true. Because these are almost as Bobbiana at Stellenbosch University. But I won't discredit the Bobbiana. These so-called scientists at Stellenbosch University have convinced the theologians that evolution is true, scientifically. I mean, I sat in a meeting where I got the whole Quirk School's personnel together, all the professors, to speak to them about the subject. And they got this Unifund and Yever to also be there. They asked me, do I mind if he comes? How can I say no? But he's the arch-atheist evolutionist at Stellenbosch. And they listened more to what he said than what I said. And eventually they asked him to advise them on the curricula of the Quirk School, the theological faculty at Stellenbosch. Now that's as far down the slippery slope the leadership in the church is. There are notable exceptions, one or two professors, but most of them accept evolution. And I have been spending at least 20 years fighting them and dragging some of them before the synod, laying charges against them to get them to turn around, but there's no, all to no avail so far. I'm still a member of the Dutch Reformed Church, not because I want to be, but because I need to be.
The synod is ambivalent.
The synod, there are a synod for every province. And sometimes, yeah, every province has a synod. And then there's a general synod which combines all of the other synods together. And they have simply adopted saying that, well, you know, we can't, in the light of modern science, we've got to interpret the Bible in the light of modern science. That Professor Willy Jonker said in three articles in the Kerkwoorde in 1996. I have a copy of the articles. I address it in my book on the Dutch Reformed Church, that he is the one that opened the gates for theologians and for ministers to believe in evolution, because science has taken on the high level of authority over the Bible. Science is true because you can measure it. The Bible's not true. You can't measure it. It happened all a long time ago.
But isn't science also quite corrupted by now? Because, I mean, this thing where you say that Darwinism changes the logic of knowledge. Now, when the logic of knowledge is changed, you will get irrational thinking, don't you? I mean, if you look at the world now, and when they tell you about this global warming and greenhouse gases and the rising of the seas and the ozone hole, and now they even say that there's a tear in the magnetic field of the world. Is that sort of in line with reality?
Just begin your question again, because I'm listening to you as you go along, and I've forgotten what you said at the beginning.
No, about the logic of knowledge.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, there's a book with the title Betrayers of the Truth, Fraud and Deceit, subtitle Fraud and Deceit in the Halls of Science.
Yes.
Written by two science journalists, Broad and Wade. They are journalists for the Scientific American, the biggest science magazine in the world. They wrote this book. I've got it on my shelf. And you will be astonished to know of the fraud and deceit in science. There was a guy, I've forgotten his name now, begins with an S, not Sawyer, but something like that. Brilliant guy in America who had found out a cure for cancer. And said, you know, here are the results of my tests. And everybody was amazed. In fact, they were thinking of awarding a Nobel Prize to him. And then somebody went and tried to do the same test himself, and he could never get the right answer. So they eventually found that he had forged the answers. Not a word of it was true. And eventually they found that he didn't even have a bachelor's degree in science. He was a fraud from the beginning to end. And that the book tabulates hundreds of these cases of fraud in science. In fact, there's a science historian who says that science should be accorded a place next to fairy tales. And another scientist said, evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. And so I could go on. I mean, and then, on the other hand, there are hundreds of professors at universities around the world that the moment they found they believed in creation and not evolution, the next day they were out. They were axed immediately from hundreds of universities around the world. So science is in a sorry state.
Yes.
But to be first and to make some dramatic discovery, particularly in paleontology. Oh, we found the oldest skull in the world. Lucy, 3.5 million years old. Do you know where Lucy was found? This guy, Johansson, he and his friend, Mr. Clark, or Dr. Clark, sorry, they were walking very despondent. They'd found nothing all day or for weeks. And they're walking in some valley in Tanzania, and there were bones all over the place. And he looked at his bones and said, "Hey, what?" And he picked up one here, and he picked up one there, and he picked one over there, and he put it all together, and that's Lucy. 3.5 million years old, Lucy is.
Lying on the surface.
Now, I want to know from any of you, just show me your hand, how can any bone lie on the surface for 3.5 million years and not be trampled onto dust, not be pitted and blown away from wind-driven sand, not be just disintegrate?
Eaten by jackal.
In 3.5 million years. Mm. It's impossible. But they believe it. Why? Because they need to. Yeah. And people are gullible. Yes.
You mentioned that you have given a copy of the book to the Minister of Education. Have you gotten a response? And if so, the other question is there a provision within the Constitution of South Africa where if you discover that something which is within the curriculum is 40, is there a provision where you can actually amend the curriculum or force the government to change the curriculum?
Well, I suppose I've had no response from the minister. Well, almost said, of course not, but I won't say it. I suppose if one had a lobby which is strong enough and have enough money behind it to force the government to change it, because it's in violation of the constitution of the rights of humans, then one could do something like that. But you need money for that.
Or could not an opposition political party do that?
They could, but would they?
So we have to comment.
Then you must see to it that they do.
Mm. But the government is being told what to impose upon us. They are not free agents either. They are being told from overseas. This is what you teach your children, and this is what you tell your people, and do it for us.
So who is telling them?
Yeah, exactly. That is a question. Yes.
Anything else?
That Crazed Darwin article, that man, Danny Barker, he was a Christian pastor as well, that started that.
Really?
And then I see that Richard Dawkins, the arch atheist on earth, he was. We started a campaign to have London buses there. There probably is no God, so we actually join. But apparently a London bus driver refused to drive a bus.
I believe so.
And also the Italians won't allow a campaign in Italy.
That I'm sure. The Pope will be upset.
But they agree with evolution, the Pope. They just said they do. But they're having some meeting very soon. But he said
Yeah, the previous Pope had said that evolution is not in contradiction with the scriptures. But he either reads the Bible badly or he reads science badly.